Okay, thank you. So Dave is a new guy. He's been here 8 weeks. I've got him beat. I've been here 22 weeks on the job. So this is my perspective as an old timer. This is a soil map of 1912 of the Mesilla Valley in New Mexico. And it delineates different soil types according to clay content, sand content. 100 years later, this is the same area, and we know a lot more about how the soils formed, their properties, what they are, how they respond to management, and we've got a lot more series. So in that map, we've got approximately 50 series. So even 50 series is hard to carry around in your head. So instead, we can group them. We can group these series into entisols, that are formed on floodplains, floodplains that are in deserts, and the soil property is not a vertisol, but it has vertic properties. And then we can talk about soil temperature, mineralogy, particle size. But if you look at all the information that's packed in to this taxonomic unit, it enables us to zoom in and zoom out in terms of scale, both in time and in space. For example, if we look at the spatial scale first, okay, and we plot that along an x-axis going from small to large, we have the Petaun scale in terms of meters, and that's where a lot happens. That's where a lot of debates take place. That's where people hold peds. That's where people look for clay films, and that's where we classify a soil. We give it its taxonomic name, but that's not where we map. We scale up to the landscape level, and we can talk about the polypeton scale, we can talk about the component scale, we can talk about the series scale. And just to illustrate this, this is from New Mexico. This was a playa lake, and you have gypsum blowing out in former times, and that created fossil parabolic dunes. And in between those dunes now are unconsolidated red siliceous sands. Okay, but we have very distinct components that we can draw lines around at the landscape level. And of course, we can keep grouping these soils this way all the way up to the global scale. And of course, we can start going down in scale. And we can look at thin sections, for example. We're looking at millimeters. We're looking at clay films that are very important for understanding the genesis of the soil, the classification of the soil. We can keep going down smaller to the micron. We can look at, you know, particles with electron microscopy. We can do X-ray diffraction, and now we are on the molecular scale. So soil survey spans a great distance in terms of space, but it also does in terms of time. And if we were to plot that on a vertical axis, going from short duration to long duration, soil temperature can actually change by the minute. So here's an example again from White Sands, looking at 4 days in January at a centimeter. That soil temperature is changing every minute. Soil moisture can change in a matter of hours and weeks. Here's a illustration showing the depth of the soil versus time for a year. The black vertical lines are rainfall events. You can see how in the winter the soil profile wetted up, and it stayed moist longer than it did in August and September when it's hot and dry and the plants were transpiring and pumping out the water. Months, an example would be salt efflorescence, crystals forming, for example, on the playa surface from groundwater that is carrying sodium and chloride in this case, and as the water evaporates, the crystals form. This would be in an example, December. It snowed, all the crystals melted. By February, the crystals had reformed, and then by May, strong winds blew them away. So we typically think of leaching as going vertically downward. This is leaching going vertically upward and being carried away. Organic matter, we're looking at decades, clay accumulation, centuries, petrocalcic horizon, millennia, and even if you want to look at millions of years and how soil taxonomy can help us understand over those long periods, we could say, well, Africa, for example, here where the erythrosols are today, in large part, the oxisols, let's go back 6 million years into the Miocene, well, pretty much the same thing. Let's go all the way back 66 million years to the KT boundary. We could still have a language to talk about what those ancient soils were during that time period. But here's another scale, and this is a scale that the biologists and ecologists deal a lot with, and it's an organizational scale. So, for example, we have an atom grouped into molecules, grouped into cells. And the cell level is very important, the biologists point out, because that is the first level where you can say something is living. And then you go up to tissue, to organs, to organisms, and then from organisms to populations. And that's another important scale that the biologists point out, because that's where evolution takes place. Not with the organism, the individual, but with the population and the genes being blended and mixed together. Then you go up to the community scale, where now you have populations that are interacting with different populations, and then to the ecosystem, where now they're interacting with abiotic conditions, and then all the way up to the global scale. So if we think of soil survey in terms of space and time, and if we put this other dimension onto it, then it's an interesting view to talk about how soil survey is organized in this organizational scale. So if we talk about the individual, the soil mapper, and the population, for example, in the NRCS soil survey, and the interactions that are taking place between those, well, we could look at organizational charts and see how the soil scientist is interacting with their boss, and they're interacting with their boss. But there's a lot more than this vertical interaction. There's diagonal, there's horizontal interaction. You have this whole population that is interacting, and it keeps going up to Dave Linvoll, the director of Soil Science Division, those interactions, and he's, of course, interacting with the deputy chief. But that would be the population of soil scientists. If we go to the community level, where you have populations interacting with different populations, now we bring in other federal, state agencies, universities, and even within the NRCS itself, you have the soil scientists that are interacting with other populations of specialists. And then if you go to the USDA level, you have the NRCS interacting with other divisions within the USDA. And of course, if you go up to the executive branch, you have the Department of Agriculture and all these other departments, all this interaction, all this complexity. And you could also point out that there are neighboring tribes, and these are people who are competing for the same resources. Okay, let's go up one more, and like it or not, this is where politics come in. And so now we have the human population interacting with the abiotic. So, yes, politics, but resources, conservation, water, development, agriculture, pollution, soils, and all of that is, you know, mixed and feeds all the way down to that individual soil mapper. And, of course, we can't deny that we're part of a global community. And just pick whatever factor you want. How about wheat? That's how wheat flows between the continents. And it's not only an interaction, but an interdependency, that one group is dependent upon the actions of other groups. So I think that we could make the link between the global all the way down to the individual mapper. And I think some evidence for that is if we look at soil survey through time. So, for example, if we just take these two and make the point that this is not real, that this is not the real situation, that you've got all of these levels above it that are absent here that are affecting down to the individual soil mapper. And to look at that, let's take the two primary products that Soil Survey has delivered. We'll call the one on the left the Generation 1 Soil Survey, the one on the right, Generation 2 Soil Survey. And if we plot versus time, the number of soil surveys that have been published, you end up with this figure. So on the x-axis is the number of soil surveys published. On the y-axis. On the x-axis, you have time in five-year increments. So you can see that in the 90s, that was a period of Edison's inventions. That was a period of the gay 90s, prosperity. That was 1900 early. That was Teddy Roosevelt and all the positive, you know, optimism. You had the Model T's rolling off the assembly lines. And you can see the resources were such. There was a lot of soil surveys being published. And then a crash in the 30s and during the World War II years. But by the time you hit the 50s, again, world conditions enabled the United States to have a lot of wealth during that time period. And you can see how these World War II vets, many of them with a lot of good work habits, came and started making soil surveys. And I have to point out that this has shifted a bit to the right. In other words, by the time the mapping took place and the manuscripts were generated, there was a lag period, sometimes 5, sometimes 10 years. So this has shifted, at least with the second bimodal population, to the right. And you can look at this through time. So these are counties that were mapped, and they're counties, not parts of counties. In the West, there were like the Mesilla Valley, and it doesn't show up on these maps. But there you have the 1900s, the 1910s, the 1920s. Things are dropping off in the 30s and 40s and 50s. They're picking back up. In the 60s, these were the counties mapped. In the 70s and the 80s, a lot of mapping being published. And then dropping off, beginning again in the 90s, 2000s, and 2010. But now we have Webb Soil Survey, and we have a different way of conveying the information across the landscape. So, wishful thinking. So this follows upon Dave's talk. Wishful thinking. What would we like? That's what we'd like. We'd like to see soil survey in some metric going up again. And you say, well, why is there a need? Well, if you make the point that it's the people who understand this landscape, that really understand in three dimensions. They understand how water moves through it. They understand how pollutants can move through it. They understand that there's a biological engine that sits on top of this landscape. And if we talk about environmental sustainability and take a systems approach, and that systems approach could not only be local, but on the continental scale, on the global scale. But the main point about the soil systems approach is that you're looking at not only three dimensions, but you're looking at four dimensions, because you're running that model across time. So, thank you. I have one.
Yeah.
Yes.
I have a question. I wonder that for the soil wax that were that going to be optic,
could you say it one more time, please?
I was wondering that for the soil wax surveys, would that be like optic constantly?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think so. Technology enables us to understand soils better. So that first generation, these were people walking the landscape. There was people on horseback, and they really were surveying because they had a plane table, and they were shooting in points and mapping the land as well as mapping the soils. And then you develop a new technology after World War II, and that's stereopair aerial photography. And just with stereoscopes, you can make that landscape stand up in three dimensions. And so those maps were so much better than what you could find by walking across the ground. But now, you know, digital soil mapping, raster mapping, different bands, satellite images, we have, and the ability to, you know, convey that information to large groups has changed. So I would think, yeah, that we're definitely on a third, we're poised for a third generation of mapping. Yeah.
We have time for one last question.
I think Alfred had, yeah.
Okay. So, Curtis,
mm-hmm.
you know, you had a very Catholic way of depicting things, maybe military, hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Is that how the real world is still? Or is the real world that people do mapping, a lot of mapping outside NRCA,
mm-hmm.
that you should harvest, that things are bottom up and not top down anymore?
Yeah. It seems to me, even though you're right, there was a lot of regimentation. But even then, it was both bottom up and top down. And so you had people who knew the ground. And it goes back to the appropriate scale. And it's been said that tigers are dangerous, but galaxies are not. So the tiger, I mean, the scale that we operate really is, it has been the county level. And so if you get people walking the county and they've got county boundaries, they know that county. And they can really understand that county. Of course, it doesn't match up with the next county, but you know that's you know a different issue, and that's where you have the top down. So, operational scale is real important, and you have to look at these people really did mobilize a lot of folks to get a lot of work done. So it did work.
Now, looking for the future. Mm-hmm.
And the evidence.
Is not top down, I'm
okay.
The future is bottom up.
I think it's both.
Oh, it's both.
Bottom up and top down.
Top down.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
All right.